Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, before we get into the presentations, I'd like to give you a quick rack-up of the operations panel's activities and kind of try to summarize for the group here where I believe we are relative to the total body of work that we've been attacking over the past several months. Operations team has engaged in 7 different activities. 6 of those activities are specific return to flight CABE recommendations, and one is the raise the bar activity that NASA imposed on itself, SSP-3, which is the contingency shuttle crew support activity that we adopted for internal review. The bean count is, so far we have presented 2 of those recommendations in the form of closure packages to this group at prior meetings. We will present 2 more today. We have received closure packages from NASA on all of these activities, but 2 of them just very recently received. We have not had a chance to digest fully and are not prepared to present those today, but we'll in the next probably the next plenary meeting. And finally, there's one recommendation or one more today that we're recommending transfer, or we're actually attaching to the work that's being done in another recommendation, because the intent of that recommendation is being met in consonance with one of the other recommendations. We'll talk about that more later. And so we'll give you status on 2. We'll present packages for consideration on 2 new ones. We'll update you with a status on 2 old ones that we've already presented. And one will be statused by the technical group. That's the 641, the repair and inspect recommendation, because there are really 2 parts to the many parts to that one. But more of the information has to do with materials development than operations procedures development. So the technical panel, which works with us on that one, will present the status today. The first 3 recommendations that we'll talk about today relate to imagery. And imagery, of course, of the vehicle from the ground, the CABE recommended that we produce a capability to provide 3 useful views of the ascent vehicle through SRB-SEP from the ground. And then we'll have the next one, which is high-resolution imagery of the external tank taken from the orbiter vehicle. And finally, the 3rd one of those imagery ones is high-resolution imagery of the orbiter taken from the tank and SR solid rocket motors. Bob Seek and Forrest McCartney will present those 3. Then we'll update you on the 2 old ones that we presented, the foreign object debris, which we'll give you a new status on and a new recommendation, and the digital closeout imagery, update you on that one make another new recommendation on that, and then we'll status contingency shuttle crew support, and then we'll hand off to the technical panel for statusing of the inspection repair 641. To date, I believe my assessment is that NASA has done about 70% of all the work we need to get to complete closure on our activities, and the work that remains to be done is quite well defined, and with one minor exception, I think that the work is well known and scheduled and in progress, and I see no problems in completing that. I think more of the work has been done than is indicated by the complete closures, and the work that remains is well defined. So I'm very optimistic about this. I think the one area where we have, as you know, some of these recommendations are soft targets, and a lot of A lot of effort has been put into them, and a lot of progress has been made, much more progress than is required to meet the intent of the CABE. So NASA's gone way above and beyond in many of these cases. In some of them, they're very hard targets, and we've knocked our heads against these. NASA's knocked their heads against these with a very high-energy effort that's been put into some of these, and progress has been difficult. So there's a full spectrum of softness in these, in accomplishing these recommendations. And we'll try to give you, as we go along, an indication of where we think the targets have been hard and where they've been soft. And in all cases, though, NASA has embraced these energetically and has done an awful lot of work on them. So without further ado, I will turn over to Bob Seek, who will start the imagery presentations.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. As Jim mentioned, the first of the three recommendations the board made relative to imagery deals with the ground imagery, and specifically they requested that the program upgrade the ground imagery system to provide three useful views, useful to be determined by the technical community so that they could capture the performance of the vehicle in terms of debris shedding and the propagation of debris, and that the requirements for these assets be made more crisp so they are part of the launch decision process, which they had not been in the past. And also, in addition to the ground imagery, look at ship or airborne-based platforms to better capture the performance of the vehicle. So if you go to the next chart, What was behind the board's finding was the fact that when they did the analysis of Columbia, there were not useful imagery views available to capture debris shedding, debris propagation. The cameras that were there, there weren't enough of them. They were not in optimum locations. And in some cases, they weren't operational. They didn't work. So the impetus from the board was, this is a developmental vehicle. It should be treated as a developmental vehicle, and you should use every opportunity to capture its performance. And where you don't have instrumentation per se, use imagery to capture the performance. And that's the way we interpreted the intent or the objective of the board's finding and recommendations. Next chart. NASA moved out really quickly on this one. They did an assessment of all the ground sites. They started implementing more short range, medium range, and long range camera assets to optimize the views of the vehicle, and their approach is let's capture the performance as best we can from T0 actually prior to launch all the way through solid rocket booster separation, and again where there's conditions where you could improve this even more, let's look at airborne assets to supplement the ground capability. The next chart. It should be noted that there's a caveat to this upgrade activity. Grant, there's a lot of good technology out there in cameras and imagery, but based on all the work that's been done on critical debris, the sizes of that can hurt you, the resolution of these assets will not definitively establish whether or not you did or did not take a hit on the vehicle in a vulnerable area when you're going uphill. Also, that while this is good data, you wouldn't use it without a lot of analysis and a lot of other data factoring into it to make any real-time decisions based on whether or not you'll do a repair or that sort of thing on the orbiter. Also, while these systems will be required, they're categorized as criticality 3, which means they're not a safety of flight asset. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't be working. It doesn't mean that there isn't redundancy, but in the proper categorization of things, that they're not a launch constraint from a safety standpoint. It should be noted that in this particular recommendation, we didn't go beyond the capturing of the data, the actual analysis of it, and how that is integrated with all the rest of the sensor data is part of another finding and recommendation, which we'll get to later. Next chart. Few points to make about the ground equipment, and the next two charts actually show some of these assets. It's not accurate to characterize this equipment as high tech. However, it's complex. It has to be set up properly, and it has to be maintained properly if it's going to give you good information. And there's various different camera and tracker configurations. Some of them are fixed, some of them are mobile, some of them are manually controlled, some of them are remotely controlled, some of them are NASA assets, some are Air Force range assets, and some of them are a mix of both parties. Some of them you have real-time operability status, and some of them are set up well before launch, and you don't know whether you're going to get good information from that asset until you develop the film. But that's the nature of it. Next chart, and that shows some more of the different camera configurations. And the next chart. As I mentioned before, in addition to these ground assets, NASA is looking at leasing two WB-57s to use as an airborne platform. This will give you not only good information, an asset, but also an entry. And they can carry a wide variety of imagery, film, television, and there's some other sensors that they could carry. And this will be particularly useful if you get into a situation where you have cloud cover that's a factor on your particular launch attempt. Next chart. This was in particular noted as a deficiency by the board. We didn't have a good set of requirements for these assets prior to Columbia, and they're moving out to take care of this. When they get their suite of cameras in place, the status of these assets will be now part of the launch decision process. The people responsible for them will give an input, as it were, to the mission management team before the tank is loaded, and that's approximately 9 hours before launch. Later on in the launch count, these assets will be statused again to ensure that, again, you get a minimum of three useful views on both the local cameras on the pad, but the short range, which carries your coverage up to about 40 to 50 seconds, and then the long range, which takes you all the way up to solid rocket booster separation. In addition to that, there's the ground power system, which has to be up in order for any of the pad cameras to work, will be statused. And again, this will be part of the launch decision process. Most stable systems, the way the launch commit criteria works in launch count, are committed for flight at the final poll of the mission management team at 9 minutes. And this is the way stable systems are treated, not only on the ground, but flight also. And after that point in time, if this fails, it's not necessarily a constraint to launch. The mission management team will deal with that as they have to deal with it. But again, since this is not a safety of flight system, the failure of these will not necessarily constrain the launch attempt. Next chart. Our assessment, we made a number of reviews of the KSC and range area of the facilities. They've made a lot of progress here. They've essentially doubled the number of ground sites, and while the number is still work in progress, we're assured that they'll have a minimum of three for the various fields of view. The requirements are still being updated. On the previous chart, that's work in progress, but they're converging on a set of requirements that would ensure that it takes care of that deficiency that existed before Columbia. Next assessment, next chart. The assessment of the paperwork, all the safety documentation, the documentation associated with the cameras themselves, that's being pulled together and should be completed next spring. They recently had a critical design review. There were some open items from that primarily dealt with the analysis of the film, and that's work in progress and should be completed next spring. And of course, as the launch readiness, flight readiness process of launch readiness reviews, flight readiness reviews, and subsequent mission management team meetings are conducted, the status of these assets will be reviewed again. The next chart summarizes what we feel is still open from the standpoint of what to look at to ensure that this thing is all tidied up. The program requirements are work in progress, but they're getting close. And those requirements should be going through the program for review and approval shortly. We want to see how the reporting process will go and the responsibility and accountability for these assets. As I mentioned before, they're a mix of NASA and range assets, and of course they have contractors that implement the requirements. We want to see how the reporting of this will go in launch count and on the minimum number that are required to meet the requirements. And specifically interested in seeing how they're going to play the weather conditions during the launch attempt with the availability of these assets, because there can be cloud cover conditions that would be safe to fly through that would obviously obscure one or maybe all of these ground assets. So we want to take a look at how that'll all be pulled together and will become part of the launch decision process. Next chart. But there's no question from our standpoint, the intent of this recommendation has been met. They put a lot of time and a lot of resources into it. They've already spent a lot of money on it, and they're very close to saying this one is all tidied up. So once we get the final documentation associated with the requirements and how they're going to implement the specifics of that, we'll be ready to close this. But at this point, we think it certainly falls in the category of conditional closure.
Okay. Questions for Bob or any discussion? I guess you said that they've doubled the number of resources that they had. In adding the additional resources, have they positioned them in a way that provides better data?
If you look at the suite across the eastern, Brevard County area, they've significantly, they've put a lot of time into getting the folks who review this film imagery together with the people who are responsible for placing these sites to optimize the locations of it. And just for reference, prior to Columbia, there were two pad cameras that were used for this. There were five short range and five long range. Now they have three pad, there's six short range, and there's somewhere between 10 and 12, depending on how many they deploy, long range assets. So because they've brought in the people that do the analysis on the location of these, I think they've done the best they can on placing them.
Let's see, Bob, as I recall also, Dick, they have employed the use of a computer program that was available, I believe, from Marshall, that allowed them to simulate what they will see from various locations. So not only did they make a judgment on by the people who use it, but they also did an analysis by a computer program as to what the view should be. So I believe they've worked that problem very hard.
And Dick, I'd just like to make a comment for the benefit of the group here. The array of imagery assets that the CABE recommended is kind of bewildering. So just for clarity, these particular assets relate to getting, and when they talk about useful views, what they are meant to provide is some sort of dynamic information that would show the trajectory of a piece of liberated debris and how it might fly to impact the vehicle or not impact the vehicle. So you're getting really dynamic information, which means that it's got to be a movie picture as opposed to a still image to get the dynamics to capture that. But the trade-off that Bob alluded to, the difficulty in this is the resolution versus the frame rate is a trade-off where you can only do so well with resolution. So these assets are not meant to capture damage states, specific mapping of damage states on the vehicle. And that's why these are not criticality one assets. These are meant to give you some information about how a piece of debris might fly and perhaps impact the vehicle, but not to assess whether or not we've got critical damage. That may not be clear.
Okay, well that's a good point. I mean, as I look at that, this type of data is engineering test data.
Sure.
And that's why it's not criticality three. Particularly though, for the first several flights, you'd like to be able to capture as much of this data as possible, because you are flying, and particularly with the new changes to the tank, you're flying with a new tank, and you want to be able to document its performance. These assets provide a good means of showing the performance in that dynamic environment, which is the point you're making, is it's a dynamic environment. There's other ways of determining whether foam came off on orbit or if there was damage done on orbit. This is specifically focused on the asset environment, and therefore, to me, has that ring of, I say, engineering test data and capturing as much of that as we can.
No, but that's not to say that the information is not going to be used on orbit, because it will help the mission management team to decide whether or not there's a need for focused inspection, for instance. And so it becomes part of an enormous suite of information that will be in the hands of the mission management team when on orbit to make these very critical decisions, first decisions to make whether or not to go further in their inspections. And so it's not that the data will only be used afterwards, but it's not crit one data that will actually make a decision, a repair or not repair decision on.
Okay, excellent point, Kathy. Thank you. Other comments or thoughts relative to the recommendation as it's been brought to us? Okay, again, unless a task group member has an objection, I recommend that based on a closure package submitted by NASA, ops panel's presentation today, and our deliberation, that the record reflect that the task group believes that NASA has conditionally met the intent of the CABE recommendation, subject to the condition that's identified, and that the task group accept NASA's request for us to close the CABE recommendation 3.4-1 conditionally. Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Jim. Next will be the sister recommendation 3.4.2, which is presented by General McCartney.
Thank you. This is the CABE recommendation is very clear on this. They want a capability to obtain and downlink good images of the external tank after it separates from the orbiter in flight, and of course they want to be able to do that for early in the flight. Next chart, please. The background of this and how we interpreted this was the engineering data imagery has always been taken and was taken on Columbia, but unfortunately it was on film, and the process was to retrieve this film after the orbiter landed and then evaluate the film. Well, of course, the accident precluded the retrieval of the film, so the finding was, as you see there, that there is a requirement to get this and get this data down so it doesn't depend upon having to evaluation can be made while the orbiter is in flight and you don't have to retrieve the film. Columbia actually had the standard array of imaging devices. It had both umbilical well both umbilical wells had cameras in them. One side had 216 millimeter cameras, and the other had a 35 millimeter camera, and these cameras provide absolutely excellent coverage, their shortcoming, of course, being, again, that you had to recover the film. In addition to that, the handheld camera was used by the crew, the orbiter crew, so that once ET had separated, they maneuvered the orbiter such that the crew could get use a handheld camera to get images. But it, too, was a film camera, and as I stated earlier, that none of these film were available for the from the Columbia for investigation. Next chart, please. The AT separation now will be covered by two digital cameras, and then on flight day one, after things have kind of settled down, the tank has been jettisoned and kind of things settled down, the data from these cameras will be downlinked. The crew health camera is a camera that has been used before, so it was a sort of off the shelf. The training prospectus and so forth and so on was available, so adapted an existing digital camera for the crew. They did change the way the location for where it was stowed so that it's ready access by the crew once they get ET separation, and they have optimized the orbiter maneuvering so that it will put the orbiter in a more optimum position to obtain these pictures. Now, in addition to this, and of course, the digital pictures, as I mentioned earlier, will be downlinked to those pictures. In addition, they have replaced the 35-millimeter camera in the umbilical well, one of the umbilical wells, with a digital still camera. This camera will be activated just as the 35-millimeter one camera was. It will provide a series of snapshots, so it's not a single picture. It's a series of snapshots, just as the 35 did, and they expect to get the same quality of data, essentially the same quality of data as they have had from the 35-millimeter camera previously, which has been excellent. The only difference, or the major difference, of course, will be that the information will be downlinked along with the crew health camera on flight day one. They took the camera that's being used by the crew and are modifying it, and so it's a modified version of the crew health camera. Next chart, please. You see here that they will then have pictures to be taken and downlinked, pictures derived from both an umbilical well underneath the orbiter, as well as through the by the crew through the windows. You can see in the upper right hand corner of the umbilical well, and that smaller circle to the left of the of it there is where the digital still camera replacing the 35 millimeter camera will be located. As I mentioned, on the other side, there are two 16 millimeter cameras that are film cameras that have been used for all the orbiter flights. So that's the array. Next chart, please. Our assessment, after doing a considerable amount of fact-finding on it, is that the program came up with, the program engineering folks came up with what their requirements were in the way of resolution. The camera people selected appropriate cameras that will meet the documented requirements. The CABE recommendation just said to downlink real-time pictures, but NASA has gone a step further. They are not doing it with just the handheld camera, which would have literally satisfied the requirement. They have also accelerated the installation of the umbilical well digital camera, which I think is the right thing to do, so that will result in two of the cameras being available. And they have completed or scheduled all the work that needs to be done. Next chart, please. The crew handheld camera is a done thing. There is no outstanding work to remaining to be accomplished on that. The umbilical well camera is undergoing qualification and flight certification. As you can see there, this work, the orbiter has been wired, so and that is wiring has been checked out. So it's in the camera now becomes the item that needs to complete its environmental testing, accept the flight version, do the documentation that allows you to test that camera, do the tests, and after you install it. And you can see that that all rolls out into the March time period with the DCR scheduled for February. Now, if you will note, that is a standard procedure that is followed on all types of hardware. So there is nothing out of sequence. There's no work out of order. It's a standard procedure that is followed. Next chart, please. Which led us to the recommendation that contingent upon the successful completion of that work, we think that NASA has met the intent of the CIB recommendation with not only one but with two cameras, both of which will allow the images to be downlinked on flight day one. So The cameras that were on board previous flights provided excellent data. Their shortcoming was that they were filmed and could be retrieved only after landing. This should provide comparable or better data, and it will be downlinked on the first day from two cameras. And that ought to allow you to have good pictures to allow the technical community to evaluate the TPS performance, limited evaluation of TPS performance on the tank. So that's the case we made, and that's our recommendation, Dick.
Okay. Other comments or observations, questions?
I had a question for us.
Yes, sir.
Do they still have the other cameras in the other wheel well?
Yeah, the 216 millimeter film cameras, and they'll retrieve those just as they always have. Yeah. If you'll recall, Dick, both the 35 millimeter film as well as the 16 millimeter film provided meaningful data.
The umbilical well camera has a previous application, space application. I mean,
it's an adaptation of the. The camera that was off the shelf and that would be used by the crew.
Okay, so the issue is, I guess where I was at, is it one they've used on EVA before, or is this one that the uniqueness of the application is it a thermal environment that it?
Yes, that's why they want to requal it. Is they've never used it in this particular environment.
Okay.
So that's the qualification. And of course, they want to make sure that the lens doesn't fog up and these kinds of things. So it's as full blown type of qualification that they do for standard type of hardware that they'll go through, and it's a good program. So it's nothing out of the ordinary. It's just that it hasn't operated in this environment, so it has to be requalled, and it should not be a problem. If it is a problem, we are geared such that NASA will notify us.
Okay.
General McCartney, ET separation camera imagery, is that CRIT 3 information
yes.
in the same sense as
yes.
the ground-based?
Yes, it is. Okay. Obviously, these cameras will not be operated until they're on orbit, so they will be tested, checked out, and at the flight readiness review, that will all be reported. But once they have tested it and checked it out, they will be quiescent until they get on orbit, and then they will be activated on orbit. So there won't be any testing going uphill or prior to launch after they've stowed and buttoned up the cameras.
Thank you.
Other comments, questions, observations? Okay, then unless a task group member has an objection, I recommend that based on a closure package submitted by NASA, Ops panel's presentation and our deliberation that the record reflect the task group believes that NASA has met the intent of the CAVE recommendation, and a task group accepts the request for closure of CAVE recommendation 3.4-2. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess I have the next one also, Dick. It's an update of the FOD recommendation, which we conditionally closed previously. Next chart, please. This is a recommendation, and what it really boils down to is that the folks at Kennedy, that both NASA as well as the United Space Alliance people, were not using a straightforward definition of FOD. They had a different definition that was intended to provide them data so that they could identify where the debris was being generated during the process. But after looking at it, the CAVE recommendation said, hey, you folks ought to standardize your definition so you will be in step with not only industry but with the rest of NASA. So this was sort of a definition sort of a thing. Next chart, please. If you will recall, the folks at Kennedy did several things. They not only changed the definition to the approved definition, now it is consistent with industry as well as the rest of NASA, so they are back to that. But they also had quite a training program to be sure the workforce understood what was expected of them with this FOD. They'd always had an outstanding program at Kennedy, but they strengthened it. They had mandatory training. This training is recorded. So it's a very formalized training program. And then they wanted to have a audit to determine the effectiveness of the training program and to determine the awareness of the workforce. So it was a very comprehensive program, and those are the conditions that we closed it under. Is that they had not completed all of that training and audits and interviews. I guess the training had been included, but the audits and interviews had not been completed. So what we said was that we ought to close it contingent upon that. Next chart, please. They have completed all of that. The audit that they conducted as scheduled in October, the reports generated good data upon which they have assessed and are taking the necessary actions based upon what they have found out. So I believe that the condition in which we required NASA to conform to has been met with their completion of their training, the audit, and the interview program. So I would recommend that the intention of the CAVE recommendation has been met in full, and that we recommend it for full closure.
Okay. Questions relative to the recommendation?
Mr. General, are they going to continue to audit?
Yes, sir. They will continue to. Will they continue to audit? Yes, sir. They will.
Okay.
They have quite a program in which they're not going to only audit, but they have also highlighted the statistics that they will gather during the process, and those are mandatory management considerations or presentations during the process assessment or the management of it. So they have will not only continue to do it, but I think the to audit it. I think they will continue to have. I believe they have annual training, as I recall, Bob, and they've also required now that FOD inspections by supervisors be made more frequently and be made a matter of record. So this is a very enhanced program as to what they had before.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, unless a task group member has an objection, I recommend that based upon the previous closure package submitted by NASA, additional information we've gotten relative to the RFI, the ops panel's presentation today, that the record reflect that task group believes that NASA has met the intent of the CABE recommendation, and the task group accepts NASA's request for closure of CABE recommendation 4.2-5. And so with that, Jim, back to you again.
Okay, and we have one more. Bob Seek's going to present one that we've presented before for conditional closure. Bob?
Okay, the next chart, this goes back to work that the board was doing when they were doing the forensic analysis of Columbia. They encountered a number of situations where the orbiter drawings did not accurately capture the as-flown configuration of the vehicle. In some cases, the drawings needed updating. In some cases, there had been changes made to the drawing that hadn't been incorporated. In some cases, there were hardware changes that they couldn't find the change order in the drawing documentation. And when they tried to use closeout photography, which is a standard process at the Cape when you assemble the flight hardware, they found that system to be cumbersome and certainly not user-friendly. So that was the basis of the recommendation, was to develop a system where you know you're not in sync with the drawings of the vehicle, and to update the drawings would be a monumental effort, capture the differences in closeout photography and make that available to the flight team, the engineering team, so they can use it. And it may be helpful if you get into a situation where you have to do real-time troubleshooting on orbit. So the program did that, and if you go to the next chart, when we looked at this a few months ago, the open items were the changes they'd made. Let's see it work. Let's see if the mission management team and those that support it can easily access this database, provide the evidence that the trained people out there know what to take pictures of and that they can use the new tools, and they bought a whole suite of new cameras to use. The inspectors actually do the photography during the closeout. Let's make sure that they're all trained and that these tools are something that that they know how to use, and that there's an ongoing program to keep the camera photographers proficient in taking these photographs. The next chart is where we are today on that. Like I say, we conditionally close this in July, but they've completed the purchase of all the cameras. They now have a standard set of cameras at the Cape to use for closeout photography. They completed the training of all of the people who are now certified to use these cameras, and they've worked it a number of times in simulations since then. So they've met the intent of this particular recommendation, and that's why we're bringing it forward for full closure.
Okay. Questions or comments?
One question, Bob. How did they handle those areas that were already closed out from the last flight?
Well, for those cases, that they still had this generic requirement to do closeout photography. So before this was put in place, those images of those, the last time there was a photographer in that area, whether it be the mission prior to this or during the build-up for this particular mission, those images they validated that they are in the database and accessible, as well as the new images. And the database is fairly user-friendly, because you can, in some areas, you can go back not only to the most recent closeout photo of this, but you can see what it looked like prior to this mission and this mission and this mission. So it's got archival data in it, as well as the most current photograph of the area.
Also, Joe, the requirements for closeout imagery were not as crisp as they could have been, and they went through back to all of the engineers involved in it and made sure that they got a restatement of what imagery they or pictures they wanted as a closeout occurred. So, you know, what they had before was a pretty good closeout imagery system. I just think that it wasn't as formalized, but they went through and re-verified, I guess you'd say, Bob, what the requirements were. So they really got a complete grounds-up look at that system again.
Yeah, and the main thing I did, the structure of the system now, the cataloging and the indexing of it, it's much easier to find what you're looking for.
And they produce training films or training programs that are computerized. So not only have they conducted training to the use of the library or data bank at both Johnson as well as Marshall, but all of that is now documented such that the people can refresh themselves. And it's a much user-friendlier system now than it was before.
Other comments? Questions? Okay, then, again, unless a task group member has an objection, I recommend that based on the previously submitted closure package submitted by NASA, the ops panel's presentation today, that the record reflect that the task group believes that NASA has met the intent of CABE recommendation, and the task group accepts NASA's request for closure of CABE recommendation 10.3-1. Okay. Looks like Forrest has the next one, too.
Yes, and as Jim mentioned before, this imagery kind of came in three lumps. One was the take good pictures from the ground of the whole vehicle going uphill. The second recommendation sort of dealt with for the orbiter to take good pictures of the tank as it separated, and this is the third part of it, which is to get good pictures of the orbiter itself from either what you jettison or on board. Next chart, please. The recommendation, therefore, said provide a capability to obtain and downlink high-resolution images on the underside of the critical parts of the orbiter thermal protection system. NASA is addressing this in two ways. Their primary instrument for doing this is the OBSS, and that will be addressed as a part of recommendation 6.4-1. I won't say in a secondary way, but additionally, NASA will have ET camera in the LOX feed line fairing. This is a camera that has flown before once, I believe, and it will be relocated into a little bit more optimum position, but is a off-the-shelf camera, and as well as they will have forward-facing cameras on the ET on the solids. And they will provide engineering data, but it will not be nearly the resolution of the OBSS, and that's why those are in addition to the primary instrument, which is the OBSS, and that system will be considered under 641. Next chart, please. They have, I think I pretty well covered this. The OBSS will provide the high resolution, and it's a part of 6.1. Therefore, the recommendation is that this specific recommendation of 3.4-3 be considered jointly as a part of 6.4-1, since both of those recommendations focus in on the OBSS as the primary instrument for obtaining that data. So that's our recommendation, is that we consider those together at the appropriate time.
Okay. So from our standpoint, we will track this. We'll keep it open, but track it along with the inspection portion of 641, which provides a solution to
both
to this as well as to the inspection requirement.
Precisely.
Okay. Does anyone have any objection to that, or think that that's an inappropriate thing for us to do? If not, that's how we'll track it.
Okay.
And we'll track 343 along with 641. Bringing closure to 641 will then allow us to close 343.
Yes, sir.
That's what y'all are recommending.
Yes, sir. That's what we're recommending.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. Okay, Jim, one more, I guess, right?
Yeah, Dick, this is one that we received a closure package on just recently, very recently, and have not completely digested and are not prepared to present a recommendation for consideration, but we did want to status the group on it, and Colonel Susan Helms will be doing that, I think, or Amy Donahue and Susan both work on this. So, Susan?
Thank you. Again, to revisit what this is all about. This is a NASA Raise the Bar activity. Obviously, if it turns out the crew could not survive a reentry and they're at the station, you'd want to evaluate the feasibility of keeping the crew on the station until a rescue can be fostered. And NASA has worked on this feasibility study for quite some time. The station program in particular has done a lot of excellent work on evaluating the limits of that feasibility. And that's primarily what we see as the major progress since the last time we discussed this at the plenary. In their implementation, what NASA has stated is that they do intend to utilize the station. If it turns out that it's necessary to do that, they will pre-plan for the first two missions a rescue shuttle to be available to go up and rescue the shuttle crew on the station. And they do intend to have a methodology by which they can compute how long they can wait before launching STS-300 and still keep the crew alive and then foster that rescue. So for the first two flights, Mr. Reedy has stated there will be no gap between the ability to keep the shuttle crew on station alive and surviving and the ability to launch STS-300. So even though we don't have a CABE recommendation by which we measure intent, our metric for this particular SSP-3 Raise the Bar activity is whether or not it is feasible to keep the crew alive on station until the rescue vehicle can be launched. That is our metric. If it turns out that that looks very feasible, in the minds of Amy and myself, we feel like they've met what they said they would do for SSP-3. Next slide. We had a fact-finding where the shuttle and station program came to us and described their methodology for estimating these durations until they could get STS-300 off the ground. Just in summary, we think that their analysis their estimation analysis is extremely good. What they did was they utilized the years of history of the station systems and how those systems have behaved ever since the institution of the space station. And they came up with what were reasonable glitches in those systems versus things they've never seen, and they have factored in to their estimation reasonable failures to provide reasonable durations. If they have, for example, a failure of the electron, that is factored into their estimation methodology, and they've added additional margin, for example, for the oxygen generation system and the ability to sustain nine people for so many days. That's all been factored in, and so we felt like that was actually above and beyond what we expected to see, where they are looking at this as an emergency capability, but at the same time they're picking and choosing things they know could potentially happen when they look at the station systems for life support, and they are putting some margin in their estimations for the duration based on that, which we thought was an excellent approach. In addition, they also have recognized that you can't just pick a duration for space station and then hang it on the wall and live with that. The other key point about their methodology is that if there is a change in the station status, the ISS program recomputes the duration, and they keep that a living number, and the shuttle program takes that living number into their methodology for decision making and tracks along with it if it happens to change, which we think is a much better approach to the feasibility of a safe haven, so to speak, than to just take a number, throw it on the wall, and then assume that number will never change. So we were very pleased to see that they actually are using a methodology that tracks a dynamic variable and incorporating that into their processes. There's nine RFIs that we have out there. We did get the closure package late, but from our brief review of it, it looks like they're making excellent progress in answering most, if not all, of our RFIs. At the next plenary, we'll be very confident that we're very close to closure, if not fully on closure, next time. The two big things we're looking for is how NASA is going to execute the decision-making process, given the fact that the space station durations for CSCS can be a variable. And so we see they're tracking the variable, but we're looking for a little bit more detail on how they take that variable and execute it in the launch countdown decision process. In addition, we're looking for the decision-making process by which the MMT will make the choice of invoking a potential safe haven. The choice is very easy if there's no hope whatsoever of the crew being able to survive a reentry, and they happen to be on the station. The choice may be not so easy if you have zero chance of survival. If you have some chance of survival and bringing the shuttle back intact, the decision-making process of the risk trades between a safe haven and the return, we'd like to see that exercised in the MMT so that we can understand that the MMT has a full appreciation of both sides of the risk, because safe haven is a risky venture. But anyway, we're feeling that NASA has made some outstanding progress in the overall concept. We're very comfortable that in the end game we can agree that this is a very feasible concept. We agree with their approach that it's not certified, it's an emergency situation only, and I think that we feel like they've done an outstanding job of addressing that. Any questions?
Just one quick note to add, as Susan and Amy both know, the management panel has asked that in this end-to-end MMT sim that we noted coming up in March, that this that CSCS be part of that exercise, the use of CSCS and that decision-making authority. So we've asked that NASA include that, and we were told yesterday that that scenario is in development. So we have some confidence it will be exercised or tested or practiced, at least, in that MMT sim.
Oh, one last comment about this, Mr. Chairman, and for the group. We are kind of set up and have been handling all of these recommendations kind of individually on their own merits against evaluating them and considering them against our interpretation of the intent of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. But I just wanted to say that NASA has and must, with their role, go a little bit beyond it. And all of these
individual recommendations, while they have independent assessments attached to them, have linkages in the overall risk reduction structure that NASA is making to assess the overall safety of the vehicle to fly. Now, it's not our position to assess the safety of the vehicle. That's NASA's job. But I do want to say that the one of the reasons that this one in particular was a raised bar activity and wasn't a part of the CABE, NASA felt it was necessary as an overall part of the risk reduction because, as you'll hear from the technical panel later on, we talk about the tank, you can't really do the final step of improving your confidence in the work you've done to improve the tank until you go fly it. So there's a chicken and the egg thing here. You want to reduce the risk of returning to flight, and yet you got to go fly in order to find out if what you've done has worked. And the safe haven concept is one of the constructs that NASA has proffered in order to give them an additional level of comfort that they can go fly again and during the period in which they're going to evaluate the work they've done on the tank. So these things are linked together in a way that allows them to get bootstrapped back up into space again and do so in a way that maximizes the safety of the overall safety of the vehicle. I just wanted to kind of put that in context.
No, it's excellent because it really, in some ways, hits the point of the how we may have to look at the compendium of recommendations and the actions taken in regard to assessing the intent of the CABE recommendations as opposed to individual ones in some context. So it's good. It's a good point. It identifies again one of our challenges that we'll have to continue to work with, and CSCS we brought into that because we anticipated having to do that that type of look. Any other questions relative to the status of CSCS and our assessment of it? It sounds like with proper responses to your RFIs, working it into things like the MMT simulations from the standpoint of the process and procedure, that y'all feel this is something that we're going to bring to closure within a reasonable amount of time,
yep.
Certainly by our next plenary. That's it.
But the plenary that's scheduled after the MMT sim, we think that would be the best time to bring it to closure.
Okay.
And with that, I'd like to recognize the work of Dr. Clark and Dr. Thornton on the next recommendation, 641, which is the very popular inspection and repair recommendation, but we're not going to cover that today. Instead, we're going to hand off to the tech panel, and you'll hear that recommendation and the work that's being done on that come from the technical panel. And that concludes the presentations and the consideration from the operations group.
Okay. Thank you, Jim, and the ops panel. We're making significant progress, and y'all were able to bring that to us, and I appreciate that. Still got a few things that we need to work through, and you're working with the tech panel on 641 is certainly important to bring in complete closure to that one. Let's see, we're about 2 hours into this. I had not intended to take a complete break, but I will tell panel members or task group members that if you need to take a break, please do at your need. And and we will proceed on in order to keep making progress here.